Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson! And a very good evening to you, and or morning, noon, night, whenever you happen to be listening to our show. As you may be aware, our show is available via podcast. So if for anybody who doesn't know and you want to share this with your friends, on most smartphones, there is a podcast button. You click it, you search for Rated LGBT Radio, and subscribe. And there you will find our most recent shows, as well as our archive shows. All of them are worth listening, and quite a few are actually pretty important that you should listen to. Please do, and we're glad that you're here with us this evening. Tonight we have a very special guest. He is the author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. We'll be bringing him on in just a minute. That is Dr. Dudley Danoff, and we have a list of questions that we want to talk to him about. And also waiting in the wings is my beloved co-host, Brody Levesque, who has a few updates for us. In fact, one of them actually has to do with health. Brody, what's the story on this guy from the Border Patrol?
Well, this afternoon in a congressional hearing under questioning by Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, the Border and Customs Patrol Chief Brian Hastings made some remarks during the House Judiciary Oversight Committee hearing that's got people just shaking their heads in disbelief. Congressman Raskin asked Hastings if a mother or father having HIV positive status is alone enough to justify separation from their child, and Hastings immediately affirmed that, yes, that was the case. When pressed, Hastings told the committee members, quote, "It is because it is a communicable disease under the guidance." And then Raskin turned around and basically asked Hastings, it's like, well, now wait. You know, why should HIV be considered a communicable disease when it's not communicable by contact? And Hastings kind of shoved it off and, you know, again, that's the guidance that we follow. The Maryland Democrat then asked whether or not that particular policy was from Customs and Border Patrol's legal counsel or another source. And this is what Hastings says. "I'm not sure if that came from legal counsel. I believe that it is defined as a communicable disease." And then the congressman asked him if there was a list of communicable diseases, to which Hastings replied he didn't immediately have that information. Now, here's where it got interesting. My Washington Blade colleague, Chris Johnson, was in the hearing room. This is what Chris reported. The next exchange was key in the discrepancy in the way that the Customs and Border Patrol handles immigration or immigrants who have HIV. Congressman Raskin has pointed out that flu is communicable. And then the congressman asked, would we separate parents from their kids if a mom or dad had the flu? And Hastings replied, no, we would not. Now, the Trump administration is already under considerable criticism and fire for separating families at the border, which many observers, including human rights observers internationally, have said it essentially amounts to human rights violations. So Raskin's had based his questioning on a report that he saw in an article by Quartz Magazine that was talking about a situation that had occurred when U.S. border and customs people and patrol people had permanently separated three girls from their father because he's HIV plus. And according to the magazine's article, Borders and Customs Patrol made the decision to permanently separate the three girls ages 11, 12, and 14, and that they had not seen him since. Their mother had previously died of AIDS in Honduras. Now, both Chris Johnson and those of us that started poking around, we weren't able to find, you know, the guidance that Hastings is referring to. Aaron Morris, who's the executive director of Immigration Equality, told the Washington Blade that the policy makes no sense because HIV has not been considered a communicable disease of public health significance since at least 2010 during the Obama administration. In quoting Morris to the Washington Blade, we're appalled to learn that the U.S. government is again stigmatizing immigrants living with HIV. Separating children from their parents because they are HIV positive deeply misunderstands basic public health and will, of course, irreparably harm families and children. And then the last point was that Hastings' testimony today in front of the House Judiciary actually directly contradicts congressional testimony that was offered last week from the acting Homeland Security Secretary Kevin McClellan, who said that HIV status alone wasn't a determining factor for family separation. So basically, essentially, House Judiciary just caught the officials at odds with each other. And so that was today, late this afternoon in Washington, as a matter of fact. So that's how we ended our evening out, Rob. Yeah, pretty grim.
That's unbelievable. When with these HIV positive parents, are they offered treatment? Are they? What happens just in terms of a health question for them?
Well, that's become problematic. According to human rights workers that I have spoken with, there has been a problem at least two or three of the detention facilities along the southern border where medications are being seized and not returned to the immigrants, and in some cases, the contract doctors and physicians for Borders and Customs Patrol have not been taking care of the situation. So it's entirely possible that the answer to your question is not much is actually being done.
Well, that is horrendous and shocking. And I guess shocking but not surprising given what we're dealing with. But, yeah, it's... That is just nightmarish. I'm just unbelievable. Any other news stories of interest that we should take a quick look at before we bring on our guests?
Texas Monthly Magazine published the results of the autopsy on that 16-year-old Guatemalan kid that passed away in BCP custody. He died of the flu. The determination from the autopsy was that the death was more than likely preventable. Apparently, he collapsed and died near the toilet in his cell. The other focus, of course, this week has been the Mueller hearing, which was critically important. And, of course, everybody is keeping an eye on what's going on overseas now that the folks in the United Kingdom have a new prime minister who has an appalling track record on not just only LGBTQ rights, but human rights in general. And he's formed a government with new ministers, some of whom have been extremely homophobic. So overall, this week hasn't been all that much good. I think the only bright spot in the week was that Trump appeared before a conference of young conservative activists sponsored by the organization Turning Point. And this was a couple days ago. And as the president was speaking, they had a PowerPoint presentation going on the screen behind him, which included a presidential seal, except that it was a heavily doctored presidential seal, which included the eagle having two heads, very similar to the Russian double eagle head, One talent was clutching a bunch of golf clubs. The other one was clutching a bunch of dollar bills. And instead of saying E Pluris Unum on the banner, in Spanish it was written, translates to 45 is a puppet. Turning Point fired the kid that put the thing together today. And, of course, the White House had no comment. Turning Point's not talking to us. And those of us in the press corps had gleefully been spreading that all over social media. So there was at least one bright spot today. Overall, though, to be perfectly honest with you, yeah, it's been kind of a grim week.
Wow. Yeah, that's heavy. And interesting, we had our top news story also tied in with health. And that leads us to our guest for this evening. We're welcoming Dr. Dudley Danoff. Dr. Danoff has a practice in the Los Angeles area, I believe, and is the author of The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. He graduated originally from Yale University, and it is my pleasure to welcome him to the show. Dr. Danoff, welcome.
Well, thank you so much, Rob.
Well, our pleasure. What led you to write the book, The Ultimate Guide?
Well, I am a mainstream urologic surgeon, spent most of my professional life dealing with prostate, kidney, and bladder cancer. And I realized a number of years ago that there was a great gap in knowledge amongst many of my patients about male sexual health in general. So I had this idea to write a populist book, which goes over almost all of the factors entailed in male sexual health, with a sense of humor, tongue-in-cheek, easy to understand, medically accurate, and I'm spreading the word, get the penis out of the closet, don't be embarrassed about talking about it, it's as good as you think it is, 99% between your ears. So that's kind of my mantra. But I am a mainstream urologic surgeon. I'm at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center here in West Hollywood, and I've been doing it for many years.
So what have you found, both from your patients and from your readers and commentary, and talking about this across the board? What do you see as the biggest area of ignorance around male sexual health?
Well, I think failure
to people
talk
know
about
the least.
Well, I think failure to talk about your problems. If you can't get an erection, or having difficulty urinating, or difficulty with relationships, whether you be in the gay community, lesbian community, trans community, if you're a man and you have a prostate, you have to be worried about prostatic cancer. I mean, no self-respecting woman would ever go a year without a mammogram, breast examination, her pap smear. But a man, very reluctant to get him to a urologist to have his prostate checked, to check for STDs. People don't want to talk about weakness. The male is a macho by nature, and, we're above it. We don't need to care for ourselves. We're above everything. So I would think that was the biggest problem that I see out there.
And you also deal with kidney stones and those ailments as well, correct?
Right. Yeah. You might look at me, Rob, as a human plumber. So anything in the water works. kidneys, urinary bladder. Obviously, in the male, prostate, erectile dysfunction issues. In women, we see urinary tract infections, incontinence. We see cancers of the urinary bladder, cancers of the kidney, cancers of the organs in between. So over a very, very broad range of urologic illnesses. But stones are certainly a big part of what we do. And when we have this enormously hot, humid weather where people are perspiring and getting dehydrated, they're particularly prone to get an attack of a stone.
Really? The dehydration is a factor in that? Is that a factor in creating kidney stones or exacerbating them?
Well, I think both. Most stones start as little baby crystals, and if you're well hydrated, those little crystals will wash out of the system. If you're dehydrated, those little crystals have a tendency to coalesce and gather together and become a stone, and that can drop down and be extremely painful and difficult to deal with. So hydration is a very important factor, particularly when we're in the middle of a summer like this.
Yeah, it's. I have to, true confession, part of the reason I'm, you kind of piqued my interest in that is I've had kidney stones before, and that was not fun.
No,
by
it is.
Any means.
It is. It is not fun at all.
Yeah,
it's like giving birth.
I've talked to women. Truly, because I've talked to women who have both given birth and had kidney stones, and at least those particular women said the kidney stone experience was worse.
Yes.
So
it's very analogous. It's very analogous because a kidney stone will arise in the kidney, and then it will come down this long, narrow tube called the ureter, which is connecting the kidney to the urinary bladder. And it kind of gets stuck in there because it's spiculated, it's irregular, and the ureter, this tube, peristalsis means it contracts and it tries to push the stone down into the urinary bladder, exactly analogous to the contractions when a woman is giving birth to a baby. Only it's a much narrower passage and a much less friendly object passing through.
Yes. I've been there, and so there we go. So Brody, go ahead.
I've been there too. That's giving birth, not a lot of fun. Not doing that again.
Yeah, giving birth to a stone. Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's just like I just cringe right now even thinking about it. One of the problems, I think, and in full transparency, my former wife is a pediatric surgeon, and one of her biggest problems is dealing with parents who don't really instruct their kids well enough in the plumbing. Now, she practices medicine in the city of Voronezh in the Russian Federation. She's Russian, so that probably helps. And unsurprisingly, just by custom and everything else, about 99% of the Russian male population is uncircumcised. And as you know, one of the biggest problems in the urinary, especially with urinary tract infections, can be caused by people not keeping it clean.
Right, exactly.
And then as they get older, it continues to be a problem. And then there's also a lot of other issues that go along with misinformation, how the plumbing actually works to begin with.
Well, I mean, being uncircumcised, or as my son, my grandson is not circumcised, says, an intact male, is not necessarily a bad thing as long as you can easily retract the foreskin and conduct proper hygiene. I mean, and another big factor, which is why now from a neutral position, I take a position to try to encourage parents to have their children circumcised, is there's a much, much higher incidence of HIV/AIDS in an uncircumcised male. And we see that mostly in Africa, in which the disparity between circumcised males and uncircumcised male and the passing and contracting HIV/AIDS is really very, very obvious. So, and the third reason I think it's probably a good idea is you never see penile cancer, although penile cancer is a rare disease. You never see penile cancer, or rarely ever see penile cancer, in a circumcised male. So, I mean, there is some risk to it. There's always a question of sensitivity, which nobody can really prove that point and not prove it, but I'm sort of neutral on it, but I definitely deal, I think, and I don't mean deal, I mean lean toward encouraging parents to circumcise their children, their boys at birth.
Okay, fair enough, Rob.
Yeah, that's an interesting topic because everywhere that I've seen that discussed, especially when it comes up in social media. People get hugely emotional across the spectrum on both sides. Well, graphic, but yeah. People who are for it are way, way for it, and people who are against it are way, way against it, and there's a whole level of intolerance in a lot of the discussions around it.
Well, I think I think there's a few reasons for that, Rob. I mean, first of all, it's emotional. Second of all, it's religious. Third of all, it's cultural. And people have beliefs that are not necessarily based on medical facts. So early in my career, I was always very neutral when asked about circumcision. And I've pushed more, I guess you would say, to the right, and trying to encourage people to circumcise their newborn boys for the reasons that I've stated. But still, as a urologist, you have to take a kind of a neutral point. I mean, you don't want to offend your patient because then you'll have no patients. So you give people
right.
the pros and cons and say, look, at the end of the day, it's up to you. And I gave you the example a moment ago of my own son, who's not an unintelligent guy, who, you know, has have a new grandson and no circumcision. So I still love him.
And what are Brody mentioned talking to younger people about it. One of the things that I'm a gay dad, and I have two sons that were both adopted very young. I got them as babies. So I've had them, you know, their whole formative years. And when it came time to talk about sex, I made a video about this, about having the discussion with them. The one thing that struck me dramatically when I was looking at other parents who were having that topic, including a video I watched with a lesbian couple explaining sex to their son, and the bottom line of those discussions all seemed to be about, quote, where babies come from. And the description of everything that happened was all about reproduction. And I thought it very odd, especially watching the lesbian couple describe to their son about sex, because they were essentially describing in a way that wasn't what they did. I mean, it wasn't their sexual experience. And I was like, okay, this is just so strange. And so I made a point when I talked to my sons about it to talk about intimacy and the whole process around sexuality, and the fact that in certain aspects, when it was heterosexuality, that it could potentially lead to pregnancy and having a baby, but not making that the focal point of that activity. What is your advice on telling kids about sex?
Well, I think you raise a very unique point in today's world, where everybody is out of the closet, and we have the LGBT, we have trans, we have everything in between, almost, as I often say, a alphabet soup of your sexual orientation. And those people, or many of them, have young children who are developmental. So my take as a health professional, a urologist who's, you know, seen more penises than could fill a Rose Bowl, is I think it's very, very individual. And I think a parent has to take a position that's very, very comfortable, that's very, very objective, that's kind of very, very neutral. Kids, surprisingly, with the internet, are very far advanced at an age that is frightening before they could really digest mentally and psychologically some of the things that they see on videotapes and on their iPhone. So it's a very delicate and very individual task that a parent has. And I think it's very hard for me to say, you know, one size fits all.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to follow that with another question.
Say that again.
I'm going to follow up what Rob just asked with yet another question, and this is because I'm a parent as well, and only mine are considerably older now than Rob's. My youngest has turned 30. But here's my question to you, and I encounter this frequently because I've kind of been fulfilling a dunkle/mentorship role for a lot of young people for quite a while now. And since you have a practice in West Hollywood, you're in the gayborhood, let me ask you this. It's been my experience, Doc, that there's a lot of late-term adolescents, which I define that as going up to age 24 before they flip into young adults, in terms of the importance, okay, of hygiene and the risks of intimacy with, you know, penetration with the penis, with the anus, with things like that.
Yes.
And that there seems to be kind of a lack of good, solid information out there about that. And when you get these younger, these young men in there, that they don't seem to understand, you know, the importance of, say, douching, or the importance of the dental dam for rimming, or the importance of keeping it clean when you penetrate. How often do you encounter that as part of your practice where it has led to STDs or other unfortunate things?
STDs are a huge part of our practice. And so my position on that, in talking to, you know, thousands and thousands of gay patients over the years, is I say, look, the anal mucosa is very sensitive. It's very delicate. It's easily damaged. It's easily injured. So I don't care what you do. If you're a consenting adult behind bedroom doors, I mean, join the Cirque du Soleil. And there's only two words that I emphasize over and over and over again, and I want to say them now: safe sex. So you want to stand on your head, do a trick, hang from a trapeze, whatever you want to do, safe sex. But be aware, you know, that with a particular reference to the anus, it's a very delicate membrane and very, very easily damaged. And we all know the consequence of unsafe sex. So cut it, dice it, slice it any way you like. It's safe sex above all.
Fair enough.
Great. I'm going to follow up Brody's question with one really specific one. One of the things in a lot of health practices these days is internal positive bacteria and flora for the intestines, et cetera. I've heard mixed things about what Brody was talking about douching, that actually that removes a lot of things that we're trying to get into us through probiotics and other nutritional things. What is the best practice in that area?
Well, if you're referring, Rob, with specific reference to anal douching, it's worthless. It's like peeing in the ocean against a strong headwind. I mean, the bacteria which colonize the colon, the lower colon, the rectum, E. coli, it's there. It's prevalent. There's no way of evacuating it. And I'll give you an example, a practical example in our practice. I mean, we do about 1,000 prostate biopsies a year, meaning we're biopsying because we suspect a man with the prostate cancer. And anatomically, the prostate is exactly in front of the rectum. And the only way that we can access the prostate is through the rectum. So we do what's called a transrectal biopsy. And the biggest risk for the urologist who does that is that the patient is going to get an infection, because literally you're putting a needle through a potentially infected area, not infected, but colonized by the E. coli bacteria, and then putting it into the prostate. And so we take a caution. Not only do we tell the patients to take a douche, an enema, we give them oral antibiotics. We give them two parenteral antibiotics, because the risk of infection from anything transrectal is very, very high, and it can be very devastating. So there is no way that you can sterilize the rectum. It's just not possible.
Yeah, I guess I wasn't looking to sterilize, but I was looking because I've heard that the enemas will remove the positive bacteria that you actually want as part of your digestive health. Is that not the case?
It certainly will remove solid waste products, but the rectal mucosa is filled with all little crevices and crannies, and there's just no way that you can remove the E. coli by doing a cleansing enema. It just doesn't work. So can you reduce the number of bacteria? Yeah, but it doesn't take a lot of bacteria to infect the urethra. The unprotected urethra is a breeding ground. I mean, it's like putting a spot of bacteria on a petri plate and putting it in an incubator. You know, you wake up in the morning and you're going to have a plate full of, you know, colonized bacteria. And it's the same thing in the unprotected urethra. Once E. coli or the pathogen enters the urethra, it then mixes with the urine. The body temperature is a perfect breeding ground. I mean, it's like a petri dish.
Well,
so
good to know. What's that?
I said, so we're back to emphasizing safe sex and condoms.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no,
right.
You know, there's
right.
no, there's no way around that. I know, you know, people say, you know, it's like taking a shower with your socks on, but, you know, it's just, I as a urologist, as a health professional, I can't emphasize that enough. And you know, I might add a footnote.
Yeah.
You know, with pre-exposure prophylaxis, you know, PrEP coming out and being developed, a lot of gay men are taking the chance and not using condoms, and we've seen a dramatic increase in the number of STDs. I'm not talking necessarily about HIV, just STDs. I mean, last year alone, in America, we had 20 million cases of STDs, so this is not a small problem.
Right, right. So I want to switch this over from the disease area to what should a man do, gay or otherwise, who wants to enhance his sexual ability as he gets older? Like what diet tips do you have, et cetera?
Well, it's good to be lean and mean. You don't see any fat guys in a porno movie. cardiovascular health is, of course, key. I think you have to be fit to have sex. Sex is vigorous. You know, it takes a lot of physical energy. It takes cardiovascular fitness. So if you have hypertension, you've got to control your hypertension. If you've got diabetes, you've got to control your diabetes. You know, low fat, low carbs, lots of protein, minimal alcohol, smoking cigarettes. Nicotine is a vasoconstrictor, which is exactly the opposite of what you want when you want to get a good erection. And then as you get older, I guess you go to the famous, you know, blue pill, because the Cialis, the Viagra out there for the older male is like a miracle drug. It's a billion-dollar drug. It's a drug of performance, not desire. It increases blood flow, and it's been a miracle for the older male.
And yeah,
and
so
that's
what,
the short,
and what about
that's the short version?
Yeah. So and is that the for erectile dysfunction? Is that the main thing you would recommend?
Well, the first thing we want to do when a patient comes to me with the chief complaint of erectile dysfunction, I want to find out what the cause of his dysfunction is. So if you have undiagnosed hypertension, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, some neurologic disorder, I mean, we work you up for those medical diseases, because sometimes ED is the first sign that you have something other than just erectile dysfunction problems. It's secondary to some underlying disease. So first we try to define the cause, and then we try to correct it. So if you've got high blood pressure, we try to correct your hypertension. If you're diabetic, we try to get that under control. If you have hypercholesterolemia, we try to get you on a statin and try to reduce your lipids. And then if all else fails, we go to the drug. The drug is a very, very safe drug, unless you have coronary artery disease and take nitroglycerin. So, but we definitely just don't go to injection therapy or the famous blue pill. We are doctors, and we want to look at the whole patient.
All right, Brody.
One of the things that I have a tendency to ask, and I think it's probably the greatest fallacy in terms of thinking, especially with males over the age of at least 40. And now, mind you, I have an ex who I'm still very dear friends with, who's very proactive about reminding me the importance of the early checkup. Give me a little bit of an age and a range for the, you know, the benchmark things that should be looked for, and you know, what screenings need to be done, and the frequency as you get older, particularly as you start to hit, you know, your late 50s and early 60s.
So every man over 40 needs to have a yearly or an annual prostate checkup. I mean, 1 in 7 men in America will be affected with prostate cancer in their lifetime. So it's a big time disease. And the only way that we can really help you and sort of cure you of prostate cancer is if we make the early diagnosis. And prostate cancer is a silent disease. So every man over 40 needs what's called a PSA blood test. That's not an airline. It stands for prostate specific antigen, which is produced in excess in the face of prostate cancer. He needs a digital rectal exam with a gloved examining finger, sometimes a rectal ultrasound, and then a biopsy if indicated. So the key to the cure for prostate cancer is early diagnosis. If you are an African-American male, you should probably start doing the screening at 35 because African-Americans are more likely to get prostate cancer than others. If you have a male relative with prostate cancer, you're 30% more likely to get a prostate cancer. So you too have to be very diligent. But if we can make the diagnosis of prostate cancer early, number one, we often don't need aggressive treatment. We put them in our active surveillance group, watchful waiting. If you have the kind of aggressive prostate cancer that requires aggressive treatment, we do the robotic prostatectomy, which is done without an incision. It's essentially done as an outpatient. It's what we call nerve sparing, and continence sparing means we preserve the nerves of potency and we preserve the mechanism of continence so you're not peeing on your shoes. So even with prostate cancer, all is not lost. You can have a pretty normal sex life. So, but men have a great, great, great fear of this screening, and I'm out there screaming from the rooftops to get your PSA, get your digital rectal exam, get your prostate ultrasound, and get a biopsy if you need it.
Excellent. And
okay.
Dr. Danoff, how much of your practice is with transgender patients?
Well, I do not. Early in my practice, I was involved with transgender. Transgender is a very, very difficult area in urology. And not only do you have the medical things, you have a lot of psychological factors. And to treat transgender people appropriately, I really think takes a team, a vertical team, endocrinologists, psychologists, surgeons, and it's, you know, it's very difficult for a man like me who's basically been trained as a surgical or urologic oncologist to deal with that. So I see some complications of transgender patients, but I don't hold myself out to be an expert. But I certainly have, my gosh, an enormous number of gay patients, bi patients, needless to say, heterosexual patients, and everybody in between.
Yeah. What would you characterize as some of the different perspectives of those identity in terms of your patients? Is there things you hear from bi patients or straight patients or gay patients that are more unique to that life and experience than others, or is it pretty consistent across the board?
I would say the latter. I wrote my book, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, which is now out in the second edition. And I used to refer a lot of he, she, him, her. And now I kind of use a neutral. I talk of couples because I think the same physical, psychological, emotional, jealousy, greed, avarice, all of the factors that are related in a heterosexual affair are essentially the same in a gay affair or a gay relationship. So in my practice, I make very, very little difference. I don't even ask gender. I mean, I ask general health, urologic health questions, and I don't ask gender questions. I mean, unless a patient volunteers it, and then we might focus. But I focus on the problem, and I think urologic across the board are the same in all of the communities. But if you are if you have a prostate, I don't care what your gender identification is or whatever, you have to deal with the potential of prostate cancer. So, you know, maybe that's a little unique to the, you know, the LGBT community.
Right, right. A lot of LGBT men do artificial insemination for, you know, when they're in situations where
yes.
they're, you know, to reproduce. It's an option that
yes.
is kind of newer because a lot of us didn't have that even available. What is your advice to a young man who is considering going down that path, and what should he watch out for?
Well, I mean, if he's going to be transgender and he's doing something to alter his male sexuality and he has any interest in having, you know, a genetically related person someday down a relationship with artificial insemination or whatever he chooses, I mean, sperm banking is the way to go. We have a very efficient and very fair and very ethical sperm banks. So we store up, you know, couple of vials of semen. I think there's a modest charge for doing that. You freeze it. I think you could keep it, you know, up to 10 years or maybe even more. You thaw it out. You do in vitro fertilization. So if you want to pass on your genetic line and you're moving away from being a functional male, sperm banking is the way to go.
Excellent. One of the reviews I read with your book, they called you out specifically in praise of your description of different superfoods that men should eat. What are those? What are some sexual superfoods?
Well, we talked, and I think at that time we talked a lot about berries, and I mean, there really are no superfoods. I mean, the superfoods are low carbohydrates, low sugar, low fat, high protein. I think fresh vegetables, fruits, particularly berries. You know, I don't remember the details of, but there was like whether it was a boysenberry or a raspberry. But, I mean, so I think we got the public's attention calling it superfoods, but I would more classify it as a super group of foods. Anything that keeps you lean and mean, I think, is it promotes what I call penis power.
Great. Okay. Good to know, Brody.
I that's a little hard to follow, penis power. I mean, I'm sorry, but that was just kind of like.
You know, it's interesting, Rob. One of the first books I wrote, which is 15 or more years ago, I had this great idea, and this was probably before Howard Stern and before everybody was speaking about this openly. And I had this great idea, Penis Power, The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. And it was picked up by Warner Books. They paid me a big advance, and we wrote the script and the book. And when we got to New York, they said, no, you can't. You're a Princeton, Yale, mainstream urologic surgeon. We can't have, you know, we can't have a mainstream book with their name, with the word penis on the cover. And that's, you know, and every time I would go on radio or television, he's like, here's the, you know, Beverly Hills favorite urologist and author of Penis Power. And everybody would giggle, and I would have to say, you know, get over it. The penis to the urologist is what the elbow is to the orthopedist. You know, get over it. We're in, you know, we're in the 20th century here. So
it's been an interesting point.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say it's been a, you know, a real revolution since I, you know, started writing books and speaking publicly about it. And I mean, even to this day, you know, you still say the word penis and people giggle. And I have to say, it's not a pejorative word. It's a body part. You know, get over it. And if you have a problem with it, come to your health professional, talk about it. You know, we try to approach it with a, you know, a little bit of humor, a light touch, but still, you know, talk about it. Let us know what it is that's bothering you. What can we do to help you?
But but you're bringing up a really good point, and this is what I was going to say, is that culturally there's this huge gap. I mean, it's, for example, in media and movies and everything else, if you show a penis at all,
right,
it has for years always garnered a much higher adult rating than if you show a female body part. It's like,
oh, absolutely.
It's like showing the penis, you know, it's like that suddenly X-rated, even if the penis is not erect. If the penis is erect, forget it.
Well, then it's a porno movie. I mean, it's an X-rated movie.
Right, right.
And then what about
what about the
vagina monologues? I mean, here's a worldwide hit called the Vagina Monologues on Broadway, off-Broadway, and in Paris, London, Brussels. I mean, can you imagine somebody? I once saw in one of the small theaters, actually it was called Puppetry of the Penis. I don't know if you ever heard of that or saw that.
Oh, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, so it was done with an Australian guy with a very flexible scrotum, and what he did is he had a light shining behind it, and then reflected it on a magnified screen and would make all sorts of, you know, images, you know, look like a camel, look like a donkey, look like a sailing ship. And I'm pretty liberal and open-minded, but after about 20 minutes of watching it, I walked out with my, I said, okay, what do you do next? What's the trick here? It was just plain stupid. So, yeah, there's a big difference, you know. I mean, look at the men's clubs, the muscle guys, the dancers, you know, who the strippers, the women go. They go nuts. They go in there. Will you very, very, really, if ever see a guy expose his penis, ever? And yet you go to every strip
club,
and every pole dancer, you know, is completely, you know, buck naked. So big, big, big cultural difference.
Well, and it also goes from the extreme of it being so taboo, you know, in media, to especially in the straight world, and I think it has a lot to do with homophobia for straight men, where the penis has got to be ridiculed or comic. Or you know, the vernacular is to refer to the penis as a man's junk. You know, it's just sort of this. You know, if the guy is straight, he's got to be derogatory about it, because if, God forbid, he indicate that he might actually find it attractive, then that would be a gay thing. It just seems like there's a lot of that around it.
Well, I think there's some element about that. Every man, I think gay or straight or in between, you know, wants to have the world's biggest penis, and a word, sort of lateral word about that. You know, any one of your listeners that is contemplating penis enlargement, which is sometimes called phalloplasty. Get it out of your mind. It's horrible. It can't be done. It's if it could be done, I'd be doing it and be retired on some fabulous island in the South Pacific. So, you know, it is, it's yours. Look down on it, admire it, love it, scrub it. You know, it can't get any bigger. It can't get any larger. I once had a patient that said to me, you know, about a penis. He said, you know, I don't care if you can make my man's penis bigger or longer or wider or fatter. I just wish you could make it a little firmer and attach it to a nicer, sweeter guy, preferably with a Platinum American Express card. So you can't do anything. Yeah, you can't. The point, I guess, is you can't do anything about size. So, you know, whether you're gay, straight, or in between, you know, you look down, it's yours, it's your stuff. Admire it, love it, scrub it.
So I'm going to assume that penis pumps are something that you definitely wouldn't recommend.
No, a penis pump is all right. There's a, it's called, we call it a VED, vacuum erectile device. So it very much mimics the act of oral sex, where the vacuum creates sort of a negative filling pressure, and then the blood fills the penis, and then you put a constricting band around it, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that really doesn't make the penis bigger. What it does is it allows the corpora, which are these two cylinders that are like sausage casings in the penis, to fill maximally with blood. But even if we would put in a penile prosthesis, which is similar to a breast implant in a woman, we can't put an implant in larger than the genetically determined size of the corpora. So penile pumps or vacuum erectile devices are not, you know, surgical enlargement of the penis. That's what I'm implying.
Okay, just asking.
So what,
get that clarification.
Yeah.
Since we've stepped into the enhancement pleasure product area, what are some products on the market that you would recommend for men to explore for sensations or just experience that would enhance their fun?
Well, I mean, obviously, the billion-dollar product is the what we call the PDE5 inhibitors, and that's the class of drugs, Viagra, Cialis, Levitra. I mean, those are legitimate. They're safe. They're very, very, very inexpensive now because they've gone generic. And if you want to get, you know, maximum blood packed into your penis, I mean, those are the drugs to take. You know, with creams, ointments, you know, will enhance or benefit the seller infinitely more than they will benefit the buyer, for sure. I mean, there are some drugs which have a placebo effect. If I suggest to you that this is going to make you bigger and longer and harder, about 40% of the people taking the sugar pill and thinking it's the real pill will say that's the case. So there's a lot of psychological overdrive in many of these products that are promoted. I cannot think of a single legitimate product out there other than, you know, the PDE5 inhibitors.
And what about? I'm talking sort of like toy fun explorer things that are kind of in the shops that you can play with. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Take your choice. You know, as I said earlier in the show, what you do behind closed doors between two consulting adults, anything goes. Anything goes. Whatever toy you want. I mean, obviously, you don't want to do something that's going to harm you or break the skin or, But as long as you're practicing safe sex, I mean, whatever toy, a vibrator, you put it wherever you want to put it. I mean, it's really, really, really hard to injure your penis. You know, when you get a boner, there's no bone in the penis, so, you know, you can't fracture anything. I mean, occasionally there's something we call a penile fracture. It's really not a fracture, but it's a sharp blow to an erect penis in which you rupture the corpora. It's a very rare, it's something that really happens. I mean, you could, if you ever tried to do to your, say, your thumb or your pinky, what you do to your penis, I mean, you'd be in a cast for a week. So it's a very, very durable organ. And interestingly, my observation is the most delicate part of the penis is the skin. The skin is what gets irritated more than anything, but you can pound it,
right,
twist it, you know, stand on it, chomp it. It's a durable devil. A durable devil.
I'm starting to hurt a little bit here. This,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. You know, urology, we tend to be a little on the graphic side, Rob.
No, that's like, Dr. Danoff, so we've only got a few more minutes. One, I want to find out, or want people to find out, how do they get a hold of your book? Where can they find it?
That's on, you know, Amazon. They can go to my website, The Ultimate Guide to Men'sHealth.com. But it's on all the booksellers on Amazon. And the name of the book is The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health, second edition. You can go to Twitter. I'm at Dr. D.R. Danoff, D-A-N-O-F-F, one word, Dr. Danoff. My website has a lot of interesting articles that come out periodically. And they can always reach me. I'm at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center right here in old West Hollywood.
Excellent. And last but not least, what question did we not ask that we should have?
my telephone went off. I mean, I think you've asked me some very, very comprehensive questions. I've tried to cover you know, pretty much all of the things that affect men that they care about. I think you're born with one penis. Be nice to it, and it'll be nice to you, and it's as reliable as you think it is. And it's about the power of positive thinking applied to that man's favorite part.
Excellent. Well, thank you for the inspiration. We will treat them very well, and I really appreciate your work on behalf of I'm sure you've helped many, many people. In fact, I know you have because I've seen some of the reviews. And I want to thank you for the book because I think it's important for that information to be out there. And I would encourage people to search it out and get a copy of it. Again, it's The Ultimate Guide to Male Sexual Health. Easy to Google, easy to find on Amazon. Please pick that up soon, today, and especially for younger folks, if you get that in their hands so they understand what they're doing, I think that is proper. So, Dr. Danoff, I want to thank you for being with us this evening. Brody, as always, thank you so much for your work and your contribution and the work you do. I want to thank our listeners for tuning in. Again, you can find us, as you did, through the link, however you came to it tonight, but also you carry us around on your phone, on your podcast button. Please click that button and subscribe to Raise LGBT Radio, and you can hear all of our past shows. Also, tune in to Out in Santa Cruz on Saturday night. That is on www.ksco.com, and that is a live show, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. And, of course, on the KSCO.com website, you can hear past shows of that show as well. So for the team here, we will be back again next week with another important LGBT-related show. Please tune in. We look forward to talking to you, and we will see you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.